Hi there, esteemed audience, and welcome to another episode of Middle Grade Ninja. I'm your host, Rob Kent. As you know, I'm the author of Rob Worm's Bird Adventure, which will be available here on March 23rd of 2023. Make sure you get your copy of that. There is absolutely no racism in this book because it's about a worm, about some bugs and a bird. There's no humans. That eliminates the issue of racism. But in May, there will be another book, Goodbye to Grandma. Plenty of racism in this book. This is about a girl dealing with her grandmother who is a racist and a problem that I've been dealing with and a problem I think is pretty prevalent after the all of history leading up to this moment about how do you forgive family and should you forgive family who are about racist. And then the Banneker Bones trilogy, which I bring up one because it's available now, but two because I want to tell our guest a little bit about my background. This is a serious and adventure superhero story about an interracial family. And the Banneker's mother is Black, like my wife. His father is white, like me. And the focus of this series is never on race. It's always about giant robot beings, about alligator people, about the cyborg conspiracy for book three. I had the good fortune to talk with a young reader on Sunday who was asking me, why are they named Banneker and Ellicott? Where do those names come from? And I was able to tell him this is based on a story that my wife wanted to tell, and her father would drill her with Black history flashcards. And so that's where the name Banneker comes from Benjamin Banneker and James Ellicott. They live in Latimer City based on Lewis Latimer. And this third grader, his eyes kind of rolled over a little bit because he was hoping we'd be talking about jetpacks and the fun of the story. But that did plant the seed. And I know that he's going to be able to search out that history later. And that is my goal. I'm so thrilled when I get pictures from readers of all races who have dressed up like Banneker. They've got their trilby hat on because they're just focused on the fun and the adventure. And that, at least for this story, is what I wanted to give to the world. So that's a very long introduction, but I couldn't be more excited today, esteemed audience. We have the incredible good fortune to be talking with Heather McGee, author of The Sum of Us, the young adult edition, or the young reader edition, has just been released as we're recording this. Heather McGee, welcome to the show.
Rob, thank you so much. It's wonderful to be with you. And thanks for sharing a little bit about your family and your grandmother and these amazing books that you've put into the world.
To be clear, my grandmother, to the best of my knowledge, was not a racist. She was wonderful, but
I'm sorry. Granny Kent, I apologize. I did not mean to besmirch your reputation.
So esteemed audience knows that I never torture my guests by making them sit through me summarizing either their book or their biography, because why would I do that when you're right here and could do a better job? Please give esteemed audience an overview of your background.
Great. Well, happy to. So I grew up on the south side of Chicago at the beginning of a time when everything was changing economically. Factories were closing, there were cutbacks in public services and government jobs, and it really went from being a strong working middle class, almost entirely Black neighborhood, to really seeing the bottom fall out economically. And that experience really shaped my life, my sort of middle grade experience of seeing economic inequality and devastation. And it set me on a path that would lead me to working in a world of public policy where people try to research and study problems in the American economy. And then we tried to develop solutions to those problems, problems like the rising cost of college, jobs that don't pay enough, that kind of thing, the things that keep working families of all races up at night. And I loved my career. I spent nearly 20 years helping to build and then running a think tank that worked on all of those kinds of economic issues. And yet in 2017, I decided to quit my dream job and hit the road in search of an answer that I simply wasn't finding in the research that I was doing, the economic and statistical analysis, the legislative drafting, the lobbying on Capitol Hill. I needed to find the answer among everyday Americans from all walks of life across the country. And so that journey was a 3-year journey that took me from California to Mississippi to Maine and back again multiple times. And what I was really searching for was the answer to a question that your audience and you may have asked yourselves at some point in your lives, which is, why does it seem like we can't have nice things? And by nice things, I don't mean, you know, the hovercraft that we were supposed to be all scooting around on at this point in history. I mean, nice things like a really great, well-funded public school in every neighborhood. Nice things like universal childcare and paid family leave so that families aren't so stressed out. Nice things like a robust response to the existential threat of global climate change, right? Why does our politics seem so backwards and dysfunctional? Why can't we just all have decent lives and do what we know is in our best interest collectively to move forward as a society? And I know that particularly young people, young people who see so much dysfunction, so much hate and tragedy and crisis in our politics through social media, have asked themselves that question. And so I wrote the book, The Sum of Us, Why Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. And it came out in January of 2021. And I was really fortunate that I think it hit a nerve because it talked about the fact that it's not a Black versus white issue. It's actually all of us who suffer in a society that has these undercurrents of racism that lead to bad policymaking, bad decisions, bad behavior that ultimately makes life worse for everyone. And then I had the chance to be able to adapt the book for middle grade readers. And that to me, to be honest, Rob, was like, I don't know, maybe even more important than the adult version of the book, because if I had had these ideas that I write about in the book when I was a young person, that was when I was the biggest reader. My job was to read in my adult life, but I still did not read as much in my adult life as I read. as a middle grader. I always had a book in my hands. And I really feel like I would have wanted to absorb a book that helped me keep learning history, keep seeing the political debates that were happening on my TV, but have some frameworks for understanding what was really going on. And that's what I hope that the new book, The Sum of Us Adapted for Young Readers, which is subtitled How Racism Hurts Everyone. I hope that really gives that to young readers. And I'm really excited about it hitting the shelves now.
So I have so many questions about this book, which I absolutely love, by the way, and it does such a nice job of laying out evidence for what feels like the missing piece, the question I've had, you know, why can't we have nice things? Also, why do people keep voting for these politicians who clearly hold them in disdain? They hate us. They're voting against our interests. Why? They're voting against their interest. Why are they voting for them? And you painstakingly lay out time and time and time again why that's happening. And it, to the point where it almost just gets like, come on, dummies. Didn't you read the first several chapters? Quit it. It becomes undeniable. So if you had had this book when you were young as a middle grade reader, how would it have impacted you? I know it's listed as a call to action. How are you hoping it's going to impact young readers, and what action are you hoping to call them to?
Well, young people today, of course, are in the generation that already has no racial majority, right? The most racial and ethnically diverse generation in American history. And the real question that they face as they, you know, become the biggest also generation in the United States is, how are we going to share this country with each other? How are we going to make a multiracial democracy thrive? How are we going to get rid of racism, which, you know, most every young person agrees is a bad thing, and yet it continues to happen, and not just in incidents of police violence, but as I argue in The Sum of Us and really show through lots of stories and individuals, you know, telling me about their lives, as well as some economic data and history, racism is happening in ways that shape where and how we live, that shape why we have, for example, a huge burden of student loan debt, why it is that you can't always get a good school in every neighborhood, why it is that for example, you know, our healthcare system is so dysfunctional. There are the fingerprints of racism in each of these areas. And so what I wanted to really give young readers is both a sense of clarity that they're not crazy, that it really could be better. And in fact, if we just come together across lines of race, roll up our sleeves and link up arms, black, white, brown, and everything in between, and say, you know what? There's an easier way. There are common solutions to our common problems in society. Pretty much every family is trying to do the same thing, right? Keep a roof over their head, make sure they can afford to see a doctor, save for the future, you know, invest in their dreams and meet their basic needs. And the solutions to all of those things to make sure that that dream is not unattainable, but is rather what we expect in the United States, is really us coming together and working and fighting for those kinds of solutions across lines of race. And so I want them to have the sense of clarity about where the dysfunction is coming from. And also, at least for me, when I can see what the problem is, I become a lot more hopeful than when it just feels like there's just 100 different crises that are disconnected, floating around and menacing our collective future, right? And so in the book, I also end every chapter with a hopeful story about people coming together across lines of race, taking on a powerful interest that is nonetheless no more powerful than a group of ordinary people coming together and winning.
So this version of the book is 228 pages versus the original, which is 355. So we pared it down a bit. What other changes have you made specifically to bring this message to readers 10 and up?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the greatest things that I heard as I was doing the book tour for the adult book was when, you know, moms and dads and caregivers would say, I listened to this audiobook on a cross-country drive with my kid last summer. Or, you know, we are reading this book as a family and talking about chapters at the kitchen table. And I was like, wow, that is fabulous. My goal for the book was to have it be a jumping off point for discussion, where there was a little bit of something for everyone. People of all different races, a school group, a church group, a work group could come together and talk, and that families could come together and talk about it. And so that essence of being a book full of stories that people can debate and talk about is still absolutely there. My editor, the wonderful editor, Beverly Horowitz at Delacorte Random Children's House, who's done a number of adaptations of big, you know, meaty adult books, was very clear that the book had to be shorter. And also the thing that I was really clear about is that in some ways it would have been easy because the book includes lots of, you know, history, lots of research, and then lots of individual stories about Americans that help illustrate these dynamics. It would have been easy to cut out the stories. Right? It's like, well, you want to get the facts in there and the other stories, those are nice, but they're just, you know, an illustration of these dynamics. And it was really important to me to keep the stories because when I have been out on the road talking about the book, people tell me they remember the story of the drained pool and Tommy Cummings. They tell me they remember the story of Susan Parrish, right? They name these people. They remember the workers at the Nissan plant in Canton, Mississippi. So those stories, the real human tales, were really important for me to keep in.
There is a story, and there's no nonstop horrific stories from slavery if we want to find them, but you reference one about a woman mangling a young girl who's enslaved with a rocking chair that I haven't been able to get out of my sleep since. Oh, that's something to give me fresh nightmares. Did that make the version for the younger readers?
I don't think so.
So I'm curious, when you're coming to young people, you want to be honest with them. You want to let them know the truth about the world that they find themselves, that we all find ourselves in. But it's a lot to lay on a young person. Hey, here's this entire horrific history. maybe you were a little bit more optimistic about the nature of humanity overall. And some of us are great, but some of us not so much. How do you walk that tightrope of wanting to give them the facts without being so overwhelmingly overwhelming them with so much darkness that they feel like there's no point? Why bother?
You know, it's so interesting. I really think that the book, The Sum of Us, the most common word, if you did a word cloud of, you know, reader responses and critics' responses to the book, hopeful, right, would probably be the biggest one. People are relentless about saying that The Sum of Us is a hopeful book. And it's, you know, it's interesting because I don't shy away from telling the facts and the history that so often is not included in our own educations, right? The Southern Poverty Law Center did a survey in 2018 and found that less than 10% of high school seniors could accurately name slavery as the primary cause for the Civil War, right? So that's our baseline, is that we are woefully miseducated about our own very recent history. And that's before book bans and all of that nonsense, all of these attacks on children's freedom to learn. So I think it is important to include some of the stuff that, you know, just shapes the world we live in today. I'm not an historian at all. And yet I realize that in order to explain where we're standing now, we have to explain a little bit of the steps we took to get here, right? Or else it doesn't really make sense. And so I include a little bit of history, but I think what's really important is that when you see the darkness, when you're not afraid of really understanding the lengths to which often wealthy, powerful elite were willing to go to keep us divided and apart from one another, that darkness also helps you see the stars, right? And by the stars, I mean the people of all races, including white people, who were willing to buck against that conventional wisdom, who were willing to stand shoulder to shoulder in solidarity and fight for justice. And I think that by showing our full history, we are able to invite readers today to say, you have a moral choice. Do you want to be like the hundreds of white, you know, young people who were shouting at Ruby Bridges, a six-year-old, as she tried to go to a school to integrate it for the first time? Or do you want to be like the hundreds of white young people who got on buses to Mississippi for the Freedom Summer, right? The choice is always ours. And so I think if you make it seem like there wasn't, you know, a whole system of laws, not just individual moral bad acts, but a whole system of laws that structured an unequal society. If we don't know that, then it's really confusing why we're in the mess we're in. The other thing I'll say, Rob, and maybe this is more succinct, is, you know, in this book, my goal is to unite people. My goal is to show the power that comes from the concept of solidarity. The concept of solidarity is the concept of saying, you know, Rob, you and I, Heather and Rob, we're not the same people. We, you know, have so many differences. And yet your struggles can be ones that I support, and you can support my struggles. And in doing that, we create bonds of collective action and strength that make ordinary people with everyday struggles stronger everywhere. So that idea of solidarity, of unity, is really important. And it's a real antidote to the division. The division, you know, when people talk about what they fear about teaching all of America's history, the good parts and the bad parts, is that it'll be divisive. And The Sum of Us is not a divisive book. It's a unifying call to action that says that racism in our politics and our policymaking hurts everyone.
So, well, This is a book that I think would probably be classified somewhere around, I don't know if critical race theory is correct, but I know Ron DeSantis is not going to want this book handed out to the children in his state. And you probably have already faced some opposition and are going to be probably facing more opposition now that this is a book that's going to young readers. We had Zeta Elliott on here last year. Check the back catalog, esteemed audience. It's amazing. And she was talking about her book being banned and the tremendous protest for her coming in. It's a picture book that was being banned that just has a picture of a Black child being terrified by police lights coming through the window that was so upsetting people. And your book expands at length about our history, the good and the bad. But I know that you're going to get that pushback. What pushback have you seen so far, and how are you going to be countering that to get this message into the hands of young people?
You know, Rom, it's amazing. I think any author, first-time author like I am, you know, fears when they put their work out into the world, you know, someone's going to disagree. I've been so fortunate that the Sum of Us has not been met with organized pushback. I have not been targeted by people who are afraid of the ideas. It has been embraced by, you know, universities and churches all over the country and synagogues. It's been embraced by corporations that have read it as books for their employees. The book won the best business book of the year when it came out by this group called Porchlight that gets books, you know, in group, in bulk to organizations and corporations. And so, you know, I have to say that even though there are some amazing writers who have been unfairly targeted, like Ibram Kendi, like Nicole Hannah-Jones, these, you know, picture books like Everywhere, Babies Everywhere. I mean, you know, just amazing. The list goes on of books and writers that have been unfairly targeted by people who want to distract and divide us. The Sum of Us so far has not been one of those books. Now, I know that releasing a young reader's book in 2023 is different than releasing an adult book in early 2021. But I have been in conversation with librarians and educators and parents all throughout this process. And the vast majority of them are white. And what they say to me is that this is the book that they need to be able to talk to their students and their children about the things that they can't avoid, the questions that they have, not just about police violence and, you know, white supremacists and, you know, attacks on communities in Buffalo and January 6th and all of that, but also, you know, why are there good schools and bad schools? You know, why are you so worried about the cost of seeing a doctor? Why is it that we are being asked to recycle and yet, you know, we still have all of these big factories polluting and, you know, we're not seeing progress on climate change, and it's going to be our lives at stake. So these are the questions that young people are bringing into the schools. They're asking each other, they're asking their parents. And I think that the Sum of Us, in a way that is uniting and not dividing, helps adults answer those questions with young people and helps those young people answer those questions for themselves.
One thing we haven't talked about is one of the central metaphors. There's a lot of great metaphors in the book, but of course there's the pool on the cover, and this idea of people, rather than sharing their pool with everyone, would fill in the pool. And you find that over and over again, these people, predominantly white people, who would rather poison everything than share. Why do you think that is, and how do we overcome that?
Yeah, so I should say, right, that the reason why there are swimmers on the cover of the book and the reason why the pool is such a strong metaphor throughout The Sum of Us is that, to me, it's a quintessential example of a nice thing provided by government, the free public pool, of which there used to be nearly 2,000 across the country. And these aren't like rinky-dink community pools. These are big, beautiful, resort-style public pools. swimming pools that could hold thousands of swimmers at a time. They were this sort of glittering manifestation of a deeper ethos at the time that really came out of the Great Depression. It was this New Deal spirit of public goods, this commitment to the idea that we would use public money to provide for the public good, right? It's a time where we went on a building boom in this country of roads and bridges and schools and libraries and pools. And, you know, in the book, I talk about both the literal exclusion from public goods that happened on a racial basis, where most of the public goods of the first half of the 20th century were for whites only, either explicitly or just by custom, enforced through intimidation and violence, like the segregated public pools, not just in the South, but all over the country. And then I tell the story of what happened when Black families and their allies were able to finally sue and say to courts, you know, it's our tax dollars that have been funding these public goods all along. And in the case of the swimming pools, we want our kids to be able to swim too. Many towns and cities across the country, when faced with public pool desegregation, destroyed their public pools rather than integrate them. And a really important discipline that I tried to have when I was researching and writing the book was to exercise my muscle of radical empathy. Right? You could say, oh my gosh, people were so crazy and racist and mean that they would do that. Aren't they silly? Aren't they ridiculous? But you know what? It happened all over the country. And I don't believe that everybody who did it was just out of their mind, right? There must have been some logic, some rationale, some story that made it seem like, you know what? It's a sacrifice to lose this public good, but it's right and proper that we should do that. Because the thing is, Rob, everything we believe comes from a story we've been told. So I wanted to ask, well, what story was being told to so many white Americans throughout the 20th century that made them believe there was something so wrong with people of color that they shouldn't share a swimming pool with them? They shouldn't let their kids go to school with them. And who was telling that story? Who was selling that story? And how are the people selling that story to the majority of white people profiting from the sale of that story, economically and politically? That's when we really begin to think about, well, you know, if the powerful people in government and business have been telling us to disdain and distrust this group of people, and they do it relentlessly through laws and policies and practices, through advertising and media and rhetoric, through messages about church and religion and the whiteness of God, right? Then many people are going to believe that, right? We're not a skeptical people, you know? And so for me, I'm much more interested in holding accountable the people who are selling racist stories for their own profit than the people who are desperate enough to buy them. And the thing that's so great about the fact that, you know, racial identity is really about a story, a set of stories that we tell ourselves and that we believe, is that at any given point, anybody can decide to believe different stories and have those beliefs create different actions. And there are white people, as I said, throughout history and standing up today, who have decided not to believe the racist stories and have decided to be in solidarity with other people. And I'll tell you, Rob, you know, throughout the work that I did for the book, as well as for the podcast called The Sum of Us, which I also think that young people would really enjoy. It's available wherever podcasts are streamed. It's a 9-episode podcast series. In all of that, I would meet people who had decided to live their lives in solidarity with people with different backgrounds from them. And to a person, there was just sort of this light within them. Like, I have rejected the old stories about how we are so different from one another and about how we are not in the same human family. And in so doing, I have really discovered my own humanity and the fact that I am connected. I'm not isolated and lonely and apart. I am not in a war with my brothers and sisters on this planet, but I am part of a big human family that knows no racial categories, but really understands that there is only one race, and it's the human race. And I've taken action, right? I've stepped out and been courageous to defend other people or to stand up and fight for what all of my community needs. And that makes me feel powerful and clear and connected and not overwhelmed and alone. That choice is always available to any of us.
That is beautifully put. I hope people will make the right choice. Although something else that you write about in the book is people, specifically white people, being willfully ignorant. In fact, you quote the scholar Catherine Orr, who says, "I think white folks are terribly invested in our own innocence. The belief that the United States is a meritocracy in which anyone can succeed if only they try hard enough also supports the notion that anyone who is financially successful is so because they've worked harder or somehow more innately gifted than others. And both ideas operate as a justification for maintaining our profoundly unjust economic system." You also quote James Baldwin, who says that what they see is a disastrous continuing present condition which menaces them and for which they bear an inescapable responsibility. But since, in the main, they seem to lack the energy to change this condition, they would rather not be reminded of it. So my question is, how do you reach people who are willfully ignorant of what they don't want to know?
I hope with the Some of Us is that people read it who don't all completely agree with me. That's been the case throughout the 2 years that the adult version of the book has been out. And I hope that some of the individual stories that I tell in the book resonate with them. I'm thinking right now of a white woman named Bridget Hughes in Kansas City, Missouri, who is a working class woman, married with three kids. She and her husband both work minimum wage jobs. She's worked in fast food all of her life. And when I met her, she had become a part of a multiracial coalition of fast food workers called Stand Up Casey for Kansas City, that had helped to win a local increase in the minimum wage and had really built worker power as part of the fight for 15 all over the country. And Bridget looked at me straight in the face and she said, "Listen, when I was first approached about joining the fight for 15, I said no. And I said no because I had been taught this idea that, you know, we're all on our own, that it's us versus them." She said, "I believed that immigrants were taking our jobs and that Black people in the cities were lazy and on welfare. And I didn't want anything to do with anything that brought me shoulder to shoulder with people like that." But she went to her first organizing meeting anyway, because she said it had free pizza. And there she saw a room, in her words, you know, that was just the most diverse room she'd ever been in. And she saw a Latina woman stand up and say her life story, talk about living in a two-room apartment with three kids and bad plumbing and feeling trapped and like she could never make ends meet, but she couldn't get a better job. And as Bridget said, "I saw myself in her." And she realized that there are common struggles. And through organizing, through actually trying to get more and more people on her job to sign up and take a pledge to fight for workers' rights, through doing rallies and strikes and demonstration, she learned her own power and learned the power of standing with other people and learned that, as she says, it's not us versus them. In order for us to come up, they've got to come up too, because as long as we're divided, we're conquered. There are Bridgets all over the country, but it's not going to be about an argument. It's going to be about people realizing that our fates are linked, that we have to fight with one another instead of against one another, and that we will all do better when we can take on powerful forces that want to keep us economically struggling and realize that there is enough for everybody.
Heather, you're amazing. Am I going to have the chance to vote for you for public office these days?
I have no idea, Rob. But I do know that your cat is very cute. And I had a black cat when I was growing up, actually. This picture is right here. Let's see if you can see it. So that's me on a big wheel. And that's my cat, Elliot, that I had from age like 2 until 21. And he was a black cat, too.
Heather, esteemed audience knows that I ask every guest who comes on the show, and I wouldn't skip this opportunity just because it's you. Have you ever seen a ghost and or a flying saucer?
I have not seen a ghost, but I have definitely felt a ghost. We recently bought a home in Brooklyn where one family had lived there for 60 years, and all of the elderly members of the family had passed away in the house. And, you know, I had a house sitter there and I came back and got the keys from her. And she said, you know, we don't have to talk about it now, but at some point I'd love to talk about the paranormal activity in your house. So it's not just me. There's just a very strong feeling that we're not alone in the house. And it's a benevolent feeling, but it's a very strong one. You know, there's flickering lights on the floor that you're not on. There's, you know, things sometimes fall off the walls, but mostly it's just a really strong feeling.
My last question for you, because I know you've got to run to a meeting with your editor, but I so appreciate you making time for me today. This has been an absolute thrill and a treat, and you're going to keep putting out books and I'm going to be here. So hopefully we'll get together and we'll do this again sometime.
Great.
For today, my last question for you is, if everybody who's watching or listening to us could do just one thing to make the world a better place, to improve our situation, to maybe get the country a little bit more unified, what would you tell them to do?
Become more skeptical of people in power who want to stop us from learning about each other and stop us from being sympathetic to one another. And if you're already pretty skeptical of people who are trying to demonize and scapegoat your fellow Americans, then take a step further and do what so many of the people that I profile in the book did, which is join with other people in your community on just one issue, something that you really care about and you're really passionate about, and take concrete actions, but not alone. Not clicking, not liking, not tweeting, but in the real world with somebody who shares your passion and your values, but is different from you.
That's the perfect note to end on. Where can esteemed audience find you online, follow you on social media and all that good stuff?
I am at Heather C. McGee on Facebook and Instagram, and at H. McGee on Twitter. You can go to thesumofusbook.com and find out all about the different schools and libraries where I'll be taking the Sum of Us Young Readers book, and get a copy for some loved one in your network.
Esteemed audience, for interviews almost as good as this one, head to middlegradeninja.com. Get your copy of Rob Worm's Bird Adventure, available March 23rd, 2023. And God willing, I'm alive. I'll see you next week.